The same identical thing has now happened with the House of Representatives.
Yes.
That there was a plan agreed to by a majority of the members of the House.
Yes.
That has been taken down to the same district judge, and he has signed an order approving it, and it is on its way to Washington today.
Yes.
For pre-clearance by the Justice Department.
Yes.
Now, my question is what we do here going to have any impact on that House redistricting?
Obviously. I mean, it means, assuming the Justice Department would pre-clear the matter, and now we have some specific indications from the Justice Department that they actually objected to the House plan, we feel confident that it will pre-clear fairly quickly. If this court were to invalidate what has happened with regard to the Senate plan, it would be invalidating what has happened with regard to the House plan, and it would in fact turn over the election of our entire legislative body, the determination of the electoral system over our entire state legislative body to a three-judge federal court in Austin, Texas, who is being asked by the very relators here, identical, they are the same five people, they are being asked to put in a plan which has had no public input, no input from the people of the state of Texas through any formal mechanism. And that is exactly what the effect of an invalidation of what has happened here would mean. It would mean to let the federal courts decide this.
Have these same relators intervened or sought to intervene in the House redistricting?
They, in fair statement, say have refused to intervene.
So that
they have known both with regard to the House and the Senate since, I would say, February when the lawsuit was filed, because our argument has always been it's really a redistricting suit, not just a census suit. But certainly since June, when the petition was amended in the state court suit to say this is clearly a redistricting suit. Since then, they have been on notice. They have attended the hearings. They have sat in the audience and watched. They have known of the existence of this proceeding. And I might add, the claims are identical to a lot of their claims here. The claims in the federal court suit by these five relators are twofold. One is that Republicans were unconstitutionally discriminated against. That's not in the state court suit. But the other is that Hispanic and black voters in Texas are being unconstitutionally discriminated against. That is the claim in the state court suit, and they have refused to participate.
Redirecting your attention to what I thought from reading the briefs and listening to the opening lines about the Attorney General breaching his oath of office and ignoring and shirking his responsibilities and engaging in this backroom deal. As far as the separation of powers argument is concerned, and as far as the power of the Attorney General to effectuate a settlement, unless we come up with some strange, peculiar pigeonhole for reapportionment and redistricting cases, if we were to rule with your opponent, wouldn't we have to overrule Public Utility Commission of Texas against Popper, in which this court as recently as 1988 said that the separation of powers didn't prevent the Attorney General from representing both sides in a lawsuit?
Yes. You would have to overrule that case plus, I would say, a whole century of precedent.
The Mars case, was the decision of this Supreme Court in 1924.
Yes.
That would need to be overruled, and the Austin Court of Appeals and Bullock against Texas Skating Association, the roller derby case, that would have to be overruled.
Not only that, but the court would have to rule that the Attorney General, in essence, would have to rule the Attorney General has to fight to the bitter end, all the way to the Supreme Court, every case.
And of course, if that philosophy and approach were applied with our overruling these cases to a Tort Claims Act against the Texas Senate, an employment discrimination case against the Texas Senate, the state and the taxpayers could never settle a lawsuit. They would have to take it all the way up to the highest court of the land, and litigation could go on indefinitely without any power of the Attorney General to do anything about it.
That's precisely correct, and I suppose the next level of step would be whether the Attorney General was fighting hard enough, doing a good enough job fighting, putting enough resources into it. There is no end to the erosion of the opportunity for the Attorney General to exercise what he's elected to do if the court holds that it's invalid for the Attorney General to do what he did here.
And it wouldn't be just a matter of the Attorney General fighting all the way through a trial that could go on for months in a piece of complex litigation, but in order to satisfy his responsibilities under the approach urged by your opponent, the Attorney General would have to go, I guess, all the way to the United States Supreme Court rather than refusing to fight for the finish.
That's exactly what would happen. I know there's a somewhat leading question and easy to answer for me, but there is no question but that what you were talking about is so.
So let me ask you a little harder.
Okay. I thought I might get a harder answer.
If the Attorney General can do all of those things, but the trial judge cannot order redistricting, how many of those cases do we have to overrule, and how many problems do we have?
Well, I think that you would certainly call into question those, because the Attorney General can make a strong argument to a court, and I would say calling into question the authority for it to try to settle these cases is what would happen through the ruling you're discussing about the state district court. But I stress that it seems to me that this court would have to announce brand new law to rule this way with regard to the district court. And I also stress that if you do that, the court is creating a void. There's no question but the court is creating a void that, given the way voting rights litigation proceeds, where most things happen at the very last minute, is creating a void which effectively turns the matter over to the federal court.
Why is that when the legislature can come back to session?
Well, it is dependent, as Justice Scalia suggested, on whether the governor calls them back. It is dependent on whether the resources are available, and it is dependent on whether you can gather together on short notice, and I mean really short notice, approximately 200 people that have other jobs.
But that's not stopping the past. The void is caused not by the district judge, but by the governor choosing or not choosing, which is her prerogative.
No, the void.
Call the legislature back to session.
Well, the void is caused because we enacted what was going to be an invalid statute. That's the void. And it seems to me, as long as this court recognizes that state district courts have the power of judicial review and the state district courts have equitable jurisdiction, what the district court did here is narrowly tailored. This district court did not step in and shove aside the legislature for the next decade and say, I run this state on Senate elections, you don't. The district court said, we don't have much time, we have to act quickly, I've set up a system, come in and change it, legislature. If you have an opportunity, come in and change it, I believe. This is not that court speaking. The LRB, because we have a fair, if you can. But in the meantime, I'm giving the state of Texas something that has the imprint of the legislature on it, has the imprint of a statewide elected official, the Attorney General of Texas, on it, and I'm giving it to you, and it turns out it was sufficient for federal preclearance, which is a difficult thing to obtain.
I suppose it follows that the Attorney General could also settle the education financing.
I suppose it could. The Attorney General tries to exercise discretion. That's the point of this case, it seems to me. He's elected to exercise this difficult judgment.
In summarizing, then, your contention is that any time a state law is challenged in state court, the Attorney General can come in and agree not to fight it, can settle it, and agree to a substitute law which will remain in effect until the next time the legislature acts. And that's the way that gap is filled.
Well, I think that it's important that in most instances you're going to have an agency that is in continuous existence. So it's a little different situation. I would hate to, I can't think of all of the possibilities.
The agency is going to act by promulgating a new law.
Well, as I believe this court has viewed agency regulations as having the force and effect of law, and so they, under the administrative code, they could do that, yes.
If the Attorney General agrees to a new statute substitute for the one that is challenged in state court that has the force and effect of law as a new substitute redistricting plan, then that is how the gap is constitutionally filled when the legislature is not in session until the next time they come to session.
It's not agreeing to a new statute, though. That's the big difference. It's agreeing to an interim remedy, which is a huge difference than having the legislature enact a bill that goes on until they come in and change it. There's a huge difference.
The judgment agrees to a substitute reapportionment, does it not?
Yes.
And that is tantamount to agreeing to a new bill, is it not?
I don't think so, no, not at all.
What is the difference?
The legislature, the LRB, and this can always change it. This court can always review it on appeal. Other parties can oppose it. That's the big difference. Of course, in voting rights litigation, everything ends up in court anyway.
You just say we can review this settlement on appeal?
Well, I believe
on what basis?
There has been, and if it gets to you on appeal, you can review this matter.
If there's a settlement approved by the judge and there's no right to intervention after a judgment, how do we get this appeal?
If there's no right to intervention after the judgment, that's a problem, I would say. But there is a right, I would say, to try to intervene if you can establish the other prerequisites.
Nobody's been successful in intervening.
That it seems to me that principles of res judicata that the court has established for a long, long time go to this, too. If there were no opportunity to have intervened, that may be a different situation, but there was the clear opportunity.
And this particular intervention was not denied because of the final judgment, was it?
Not that I'm aware. I have to say
the basis for the denial, as reflected in the order, was a lack of standing under the decision of this case, was it not?
I believe that's so, yes.
Counsel, on the new house redistricting plan, which was approved yesterday, it is stated that 76 of the 150 members of the House approved the plan. My question to you is, what rights do the 74 members who did not approve the plan have?
They have the right to try to intervene to challenge if the standing might be denied. They have a right to implore the governor or the LRB to convene to change this matter. They're individuals standing alone, just as the 76 people that signed and asked the state to do this are individuals. There is no formal action. They can vote. If they come into session, they can vote, and they can vote against this. They can come up with another plan.
Once it has been approved by the federal government, is in reality, do they really have any remedy at all?
Yes. In reality, they, again, if the governor were to call them in special session or the next regular session of the legislature, they can come in and do what you do in the legislative bodies, try to get another bill enacted.
Has that ever been done?
I don't know that we've ever had a situation like this, because this is the first time in which, on something other than the question of cutting county lines that I am aware of there being, with regard to the House, that I'm aware of there being state constitutional law challenges, and this is the first decade of redistricting in which we're operating under the United States Supreme Court decision that whatever the standards ultimately turn out to be, one party can claim that the legislative enactment of another discriminates against them as a party.
Mr. Hicks,
it's a very unique situation.
I have two questions. Maybe I just have one. All the other cases that you're referring to, where the Attorney General has a power to settle with the court approval, a challenge to a state law, the effect then is the status quo ante. The state law that was challenged does not exist anymore, and you go to what that I can think of. In this effect, though, this settlement substitutes a new state law, and you say it's an interim, but this interim plan can constitutionally last until 2001 if nobody does anything.
Yes.
In the interim. Can you point to another example where the settlement that the state attorney general enters into results in a new order, different from what either the legislature has passed or what was previously in effect before the most recent legislative passage has been struck down, so that in effect there is a new piece of law sitting there which governs the state?
Standing here quickly, I can't, but I can say...
Let me suggest one to you. It's called Kilgarn versus Martin. That was done in 1965 by the Federal District Court in
Houston
for the Southern District of Texas. It had to do with Senate redistricting.
I thought of mentioning that to the
federal
court.
The federal court, we concede, does this all the time.
But
a supremacy clause problem there, though. Can you tell me of a state court that has entered into an order which sets up a new structure?
The problem with answering that is there is no other situation like this, because here, if the court doesn't step in, there is nothing there. It isn't status quo ante. It's nothing.
Well, I understand that.
I mean, that's the big difference.
Is redistricting, in fact, unique?
It is very different because of Section 5. I would say that. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act makes it very different.
Why isn't it exactly like education?
Well, there is nothing, in effect, if the court invalidates, says we can't carry forward with SB 31, or if the Justice Department says you can't. Only things that had been pre-cleared before can go into effect. In this particular instance, the state of Texas has an old Senate election plan, but it's unconstitutional because of the growth of population, including the overall population and minority population. It could not be implemented because it would be unconstitutional in violation of the 14th Amendment, the Voting Rights Act, and everything else. There's nothing to put into its place.
But the same thing is true of education finance. It's just that the court say the effect of it to give the legislature time to react. But it need not have done that. It could have just said, as of this minute, this unconstitutional system cannot go forward.
I suppose that's a possibility.
Counsel, you have said that with respect to the Senate, you had 19 senators. With respect to the House, you had 76 House members. You predicated your actions and your authority on their approval.
But we have not.
Had you not had the 19 senators or the 76 members of the House, would you have had authority to do what you did?
I believe we would have. It would have been a closer question and more difficult. But the Attorney General, that's the job of the Attorney General.
Why is it a closer question? Why did you have to have even one Senate?
Well,
I don't understand.
Legally, I think we didn't have to have any. But I'm just saying, it would be closer. It would be harder for the Attorney General, because the Attorney General is answerable to all the people of Texas, and the Attorney General has to make a judgment about this. And that's part of the very, I mean, this is not, there's not one particular element you can pull out and say, this was determined, this was determined, this was determined. You have to put it all together, and that's the reason mandamus would be so outrageous to issue here. Our view certainly is that the Attorney General has the authority, but the Attorney General tries to exercise discretion in doing it, and it seems appropriate to get the judgment formally, informally, or whatever, of as many people as you can in this process. At this time, there was very little time to get all of this input.
Maybe we should order some education.
Well, I think we just signed the judgment a few minutes ago.
So in this limited circumstance, the Attorney General holds all power granted to all three branches under the Texas Constitution.
No, it has no judicial power.
Well,
no legislative power.
If there's an agreement between the parties and the court has a ministerial duty to enter a judgment based upon an agreement, that vests all power in the judgment.
I don't think there's a ministerial duty. I don't think we could have mandamused Judge Ramirez to enter the order that we proposed through the joint motion. So I don't think there was a ministerial duty. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from interveners.
May it please the court, Mr. James C. Harrington will present argument for the interveners.
Good morning. Appreciate the opportunity to address a few comments to you. And there are three that we'd like to make on behalf of the interveners. And the first point is that the relators here basically we believe are laying behind the log and should not be able to take advantage of that. They had every opportunity to fully try and participate in this case in front of Judge Ramirez. They knew, since Judge Nolan entered the order on behalf of the three-judge court at the end of July, or when the motion was served on them before that, that this was a redistricting case. Judge Nolan says so in his order. They did not want to submit to the jurisdiction of the court. They did not want to have to sit in Edinburgh, go through the tedious trial, and have to participate in the conclusion that the judge reached because of the consequences they had to face. There's no doubt that SB 31 was unconstitutional and discriminated against minorities. They did not want to be bound by that judgment because they would have collateral estoppel and res judicata problems in their federal suit. That's why they stood out. That's why they did not participate in the House plan last week, 2 weeks ago. They knew about it. They deliberately chose not to participate in the forum and they have tried to short-circuit that process by coming here doing an end run. That defeats the very purpose of the Texas judicial system. That also brings me to the second point, and that's a point that not one person has mentioned yet, and that is that this plan that has been approved immeasurably enhances the minority voting rights of Mexican Americans in Texas. It increases by 3 the members of the Senate from minority districts. It's a dramatic improvement. And the effect of your granting a mandamus is to set aside that plan and to set aside Senate Bill 31 and to leave in place the 1980 plan. That's the effect. And that's what they want to do. They don't claim, they don't challenge the findings of the judge.
Mr. Harrington, is the effect not that, but let the federal court do the plan rather than just a meeting?
That may ultimately be where we end up.
And the federal court could enact the identical plan. It's not very likely, but they could do it.
That's right. Not very likely.
You don't challenge the right of the relators to be in federal court at this time, do you?
No, we do not. We don't challenge the right to be in federal court. We challenge the right to come here after having deliberately and calculatedly avoided the trial.
And the federal courts may still undo whatever this court or the district court.
I think that there are severe collateral and res judicata problems that the federal courts, under principles of federalism, would have to adhere to. If you approve this, if you approve the new plans that Judge Ramirez approved, I find it very difficult that the federal court can set those aside. I don't think that could happen.
Why are they less empowered to set aside that kind of plan than one past the plan?
Well, because, Judge Heck, what has happened in this case is that the plan has been declared unconstitutional because it discriminates. There is a new plan now that eliminates that discrimination. That eliminates the very contention that they purport to bring forward in federal court.
Don't the relators have additional claims, though, that relate to fairness to political parties
that are not
challenged in this court and that are not before?
That's right.
Are not in the state system.
That's right. And that's completely different issue. They can try that differently. As a Republican or Democratic gerrymandering case has different standards than a discrimination case of the kind that we're talking about. They can try that. In federal court. We're not arguing with their position. We're saying is that their claims in federal court about discrimination should have been dealt with in state court where they had the opportunity instead of doing an end run around that whole process and coming here and trying to set it aside. I think it's also interesting to note that despite the claim about power, separation of powers, there's not one legislator here on their side. There's not one executive branch member here on their side. But yet it is that tripart system that they invoke to set aside a judgment that everybody agrees immeasurably enhances the minority voting rights of Mexican Americans.
If these relators were not also plaintiffs in a federal case that involves some of the same issues, would you be challenging their standing rights if these were just 5 other citizens not otherwise involved in litigation?
We could very well.
The issue that they're in court somewhere else, or the issue that they did not try to participate in the.
That's
in the
issue,
trial.
Judge. The reason we bring up the other court is because that shows that they knew what was going on. They were fully aware of all the litigation going on in the state court.
But the real issue is you say that these relators must have at least tried, or perhaps you say they have to have participated in the trial court procedure in order to seek a mandamus.
That's right.
Which one is it? Tried to participate or actually have participated?
Well, I think they're both the same. I think tried to have participated, and if they were denied, and I don't know how they could have been denied.
The two persons who did attempt to intervene, then you say would have had standing to bring a...
I can't hear what you said.
The acoustics in the room are not perfect. The two persons who attempted unsuccessfully to intervene in this... matter in the trial court, then you say would have had standing to be here as relators?
Senators Lucio and Sims?
Yes.
Yeah, I think if they had timely filed the intervention, not as legislators, they don't have standing as legislators to claim, well, I'm adversely affected.
As citizens.
But as citizens, they had done that timely, would have been a different situation than what happened here. It's interesting, too, that if you can see from the order reflecting the Sims-Lucio attempt at intervention, that both of them conceded that the settlement plan was better for minorities, from the Mexican-American community, than the old plan. They both conceded that at the trial.
Mr. Harrington, what opportunity would these relators have to intervene in a judgment that was entered on the same day the petition was filed and service citation waived and the agreement entered all on one day?
Well, I think, Judge Cornyn, to answer your question, is that on August 22nd, when Judge Romita signed the order on temporary injunction that we've been here before you on before, in that order he says the parties are to submit new plans and prepare new plans. The moment that order came out, that should have really sent a message to them that something was going to happen eventually in that litigation. And they sidestepped that opportunity to intervene at that point. They could have come back, as the senators did, and perhaps filed a motion for a new trial in Quiroz.
Well, under Supreme Court of Texas authority, there is no legal right to intervene once the judgment is entered. Do you concede that
notion? I really don't.
No,
I think I don't concede that. I mean, that may well be the law, but I think in a situation like this, if intervention... Well, first of all, you have a parallel judgment. You have MENA, both cases being settled at the same time. The reason that Quiroz was entered was because we didn't know how to deal procedurally with the fact that MENA was here as a consolidated case.
Well, there was a stay.
That's right, there was a stay. And then we petitioned you all to free that up, and you did, and went back, and then was settled. The identical settlement. Quiroz was really a procedural device in order to move the Senate plan off to the Justice Department for approval, because we didn't know how long it would take for you all to act. And the consensus has always been in the litigation, no matter how adversarial it's been, that we want to have a new plan, if possible, for the spring primary.
So there's no meaningful right to intervene in a lawsuit that's filed and judgment entered on the same day without notice of these.
Well, I think that would provide exactly the reason there ought to be an intervention, there would be an exception to the rule. If the rule is as rigorous as you stated, then that would be a perfect example in which there would be an exception to that rule.
Unless we carve out an exception.
You're a better expert on that than I am, and I'm sure you'd be willing to carve out the exception. I wanted to, Judge Phillips, about citing you some examples where the Attorney General has made agreements about constitutionality and how that has effectively changed the statute. And that is in cases, for example, where you have exclusions. And I'll give you a few examples, like exclusion of farm workers from workers' compensation or unemployment compensation. When the judge has declared those unconstitutional, those exclusions, and then later on we've come back and settled it with the consent of the Attorney General, the effect is to create a new statute, is to cover those farm workers, and it changes the nature of the statute because it means you have more expenditures. For example, $17 million a year in unemployment benefits go to farm workers as a result of the declaration the statute was unconstitutional and the agreement that in fact farm workers would be covered under that law. So it does happen. That's a good example where you're talking about it. The same thing in sex discrimination cases. When you have a sex discrimination case that affects women, and you eliminate that discrimination, that has the effect of actually changing the statute. And if there are benefits or whatever are attached to that, that means that obviously that affects the state flow of funds.
Do you have a specific case in mind there in this state?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a specific case in this state in mind?
Well, the ones I saw the farm worker cases.
No, Camarena, I understand. How about
and Delgado, that was a workers' comp case. And there's a Vic, out of Amarillo, it's Vic, I can't remember this, a company, it's a sex discrimination case. I'll be happy to send that in, since it actually decided under the Equal Rights Amendment, as is this case.
Any other questions?
With final action being taken, this case, is there any reason why Richards against MENA originally, you've been here on before, I'll not mention this, mandamus regarding temporary action, now the final action, is there any reason why it shouldn't, that part of the case shouldn't be dismissed?
I think that's right.
Is it not moot? Is it not moot?
Your prior order, you mean?
The direct appeal from the temporary injunction.
I think that's right. That's right. That brings, if I could just make one last point about...
Somebody will ask you a question.
Okay.
What was that last point?
Thank you, Judge. I'm glad to have it coming from both sides of the bench. and that is, I make this point in the supplemental brief that we filed this morning, And that is the nature of the 1876 Constitution. And when the voters ratified that and was drafted, both the executive branch and the legislative branch faced deliberate restrictions on their power. And when it got to when it came around to debating, and that was intentional, they wanted to eliminate the power of the executive and the legislature. And when it got around to the judicial, though, it was the opposite philosophy, that they felt that the only way that the judges, that the only protection people were really going to have with regard to their rights was an expansive judiciary. And that's why the power in the judiciary article is as strong as it is. And you go back and read the history of the debates at that time, and the voters would expect, I believe, that the judiciary would fill the void. And the way that the voters actually put the check on the judiciary at that time was through election. We moved from appointed judges to elected judges at that time. And that was the way the people would have the check on the judges. But it was the anticipation that the only way that people's rights were actually going to be protected was through the judiciary, that that article was, is as expansive and plenary as it is. And that's why we're here today. We're asking you to overrule the mandamus and to, by your ruling, to affirm and protect the rights of the Mexican-American voters in Texas who, by the Senate plan, have gained 3 new seats in the Senate, immeasurably improving their rights. And coming up the pike eventually, which they again refuse to participate in, is the House plan that raises by 5 or 6 minority districts, a significant improvement.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, may it please the Court, I'd like to address as many of these issues as I can. What we're dealing with here is not a legislative failure to act. We're dealing with a statute that the Attorney General has refused to enforce. Now, they make much of the fact that we did not appear in Hidalgo County. My response there is simple. We had no reason to believe that the Attorney General was going, along with the judge, was going to overrule the Constitution. We had no reason to believe that the Constitution would be ignored. And by the same token, while we do not believe a number of the statutes or cases that have been cited here would be overruled by granting our mandamus, there are cases that definitely would be. This Court would definitely have to overrule Avery versus Midland. This Court, we believe, would also definitely have to overrule Houston Chronicle versus Maddox. And that's a 1989 opinion, and I will just read from it briefly. Because we hold that the Attorney General and the District Judge's actions violate the constitutional prohibition against suspending laws, there the Open Records Act, we conditionally grant the mandamus against the Attorney General. Now, keep in mind, it was the Caro's plan, the one-day plan that was pre-cleared, that came through the Justice Department. However, pre-clearance has certainly never been the first and foremost in the minds of the Attorney General. They've taken an unpre-cleared plan, which they say may be pre-cleared at some time in the future, and went down and got an order entered yesterday. Now, that was certainly without notice to anyone. We had
on the purpose of submitting the plan for pre-clearance and the fact that he was by the legislature court order.
Under the Justice Department rules, it is supposed to be submitted by an authorized authority. We, of course, think the Justice Department was wrong insofar as accepting the plan that was part of the judgment. We think it not only violates state laws, we think it violates the Justice Department rules. Nevertheless, they have done it. Keep in mind also, their preclearance only takes care of Section 5. What is left, and will be litigated starting this afternoon in federal court, and we certainly take issue with the interveners in this case, is the dilution, or the dilution issues under Section 2 and the 14th and 15th Amendment constitutional issues.
If the Attorney General had vigorously contested this case by the interveners, had fought it all the way up to this court, would the judge or any court have had the power to set aside the state's redistricting plan and fashion a substitute plan?
Would this court have had the power, Your Honor?
District court, or any court up the appellate chain in Texas?
I do not believe so, and I believe that's Avery versus Midland, and I believe that's the state constitution. Keep in mind, the state is now admitting that the legislature could convene. It's now admitting that the LRB could convene.
Does this court have the power, for instance, to fashion a plan that meets the constitutional mandate regarding the state's responsibility for education? Does any court in the state of Texas?
I believe it certainly does with regard to education.
I mean, what's the difference between Article 3 that says the legislature shall provide a redistricting of the House and Senate of the state of Texas, and Article 7 that says the legislature shall devise an efficient system of financing education?
Again, it's an issue that is purely a state issue, Your Honor. It doesn't get into federal questions at all. Clearly, redistricting does. And I will give you an example of another state.
Okay, it's a federal law or constitution that prohibits Judge Ramirez from being able to make this order?
I think clearly yes, because the state... here's both a state and a 14th Amendment issue, Your Honor. The state of Texas, through its constitution, has given the people the right to vote, the right to elect their legislature, and to have that legislature do the redistricting. All right? By the same token, when that right is taken away, as Judge Ramirez and the Attorney General have taken it away, and that clearly they have, I think you not only have a state constitutional issue, you have a 14th Amendment due process issue.
Counsel, how can you argue that they take it away if the governor convene the legislature at any time and draw a plan that they like?
Well, because then the elected representatives of the state of Texas would be in session, and then every elected one would be able to participate instead of
usurpation here when that alternative is still available, when the governor could convene it and they could act at any time to draw a new plan. If they wanted to meet tomorrow, if the governor called them, convened them tomorrow, they could go in and they could draw a plan by tomorrow afternoon and make this all available.
That would be fine, Your Honor, and
the alternative is there. There's no usurpation. There is an abrogation until they do exactly that.
And that, of course, would vindicate the voting rights of everyone, not just the Attorney General and the interveners in this case. That would satisfy, arguably, the constitutional requirements, which we're saying have not been satisfied. It would not let the Attorney General, in effect, suspend or abrogate SB 31 and pass his own statute. It would provide the constitutionally mandated procedure. It would follow the procedure that's mandated.
Did the Attorney General throw out Senate Bill 31, or did the district court do that?
I believe they did it by agreement, Your Honor. Certainly they agreed to the order, gave it to the judge, and he signed it.
You're talking as if the Attorney General is acting in an autocratic and authoritarian manner when every step of the process has been approved by the commissioner.
It has been approved incorrectly, we believe, Your Honor. I don't think every step of the process has been approved by the judiciary, because we are here looking to disapprove that process, and that's why we will also be moving to federal court this afternoon.
Mr. McKinnis, I want to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Hicks a moment ago with regard to the House plan. Is what we do here today going to be determinative on what happens on that House plan?
It will be, Your Honor, if you grant the mandamus. It will not be, in my judgment, if you deny it, because I think we will still have the voting rights issues and the federal constitutional issues left to us. And I don't believe there will be any issues of collateral estoppel.
Does that mean, then, if we deny this mandamus, that you and your clients will not be back here next week making the same arguments about the House plan that you are presently making about the Senate plan?
Yes, I can say to you, Your Honor, we will not be back here next week. Now, I would hope that you wouldn't want me to be back here next week in either event.
Counsel, if I understand your response to Justice Phillips' question, then it's not really the one sentence in Avery against Midland, later reversed on other grounds, that restricted the judge's power to enter a redistricting plan, but it is a federal constitutional argument.
Well, it's both, Your Honor, and I may be incorrect with regard to the school
with regard to the Steele plan, because I'm not that familiar with it, but I will give you another example that I think is apposite. We just had a trial down in Brownsville with regard to Texas higher education, and that case was tried, and the jury found that there was no discrimination with regard to Texas higher education or along those lines. Now, if the Attorney General had decided not to try that, my question would be, well, then could he have entered into a settlement with Maldef or whoever else the other parties were and moved UT Austin to Brownsville?
And under your reasoning, whether it was that or simply imparting some more modest relief, you don't believe the Attorney General would have the authority to settle that case?
I don't believe that he could settle that case. No, I do not.
And
I genuinely don't. But, for example, Your Honor, with regard to your Tort Claims Act case, I don't believe he can settle that case either, because that statute provides that only the government is the ultimate arbiter of settlement under those under that statute.
And an employment discrimination case against the Senate, that can't be settled by me?
If he doesn't change the law.
And with reference...
Certainly, he's been sued under the statute. He's not displacing the statute. They're interpreting a statute there, not eliminating it.
With reference to the proceedings that occurred in Hidalgo County, right up from the start to the finish, were you or your clients in attendance at that proceeding?
We were not in attendance, Your Honor, I don't believe, until after we had filed our suit in federal court. We really didn't get involved until...
Were you in attendance there from at least August the 22nd on?
Not always, no, Your Honor.
Had that opportunity and were aware of the proceedings?
We were certainly aware of the proceedings, again, and felt there was no reason for us to intervene in those proceedings. Up until October the 7th, the Attorney General was defending SB 21.
Your federal constitutional argument that you say now restrains the trial court's ability to act, that is not an argument you have advanced in your brief, is it?
In this court, no, Your Honor, it is not. With that regard, it has been advanced in federal court.
But not before this court?
Not at this time, no, Your Honor.
In fact, with reference to your brief, other than the brief references to this decision of our court that was later reversed on other grounds in pages 20 and 22, most of the 30 pages of the brief, like your opening statement to this court, is an attack on the Attorney General's power to settle rather than the trial court's ability to redistrict. And in that regard, I do want to give you an opportunity to answer the same question I asked opposing counsel. How can we restrict the power of the Attorney General to settle, as you have requested us to do, without overruling Public Utility Commission of Texas against Colfer, the Mars case from 24, and a series of cases acknowledging the broad authority of the Attorney General?
Again, Your Honor, I would say to that, he has the authority to settle cases so long as he does not run afoul of both Avery, but also the Houston Chronicle case. He can't suspend statutes, and that's what he's done. He can't supplant a statutory scheme, and that's what he's done. SB 31 is gone. It's history.
Your feeling is that the Attorney General was without power to affect the settlement on the unemployment and workers' compensation cases for farm workers that Mr. Harrington just told us about?
You know, again, I'm just not familiar with those particular cases. If he settled them and the cases remained on the books, in effect, and were effective, yes, I would say he would. But certainly he does not have the power to rewrite that statute. And, for example, analogous there would be to say, well, you can discriminate on the basis of national origin, but not on the basis of race. You can't write a piece out of the statute. SB 31 was completely rewritten. It is no longer. In fact, it was abandoned by the Attorney General. In the analogous instance in the farm workers case, Your Honor, would be the Attorney General's failing to abide by the statute, failing to enforce the statute.
Well, is that exactly what he did when he settled a case that took out the exception that was in the unemployment and workers' compensation statutes that excluded farm workers? Is that precisely what the Attorney General did?
You know, I don't, again, I just don't believe so, Your Honor, but not being as familiar with it as perhaps I should be, again, I think the case is far more analogous to our Houston Chronicle case, where the Attorney General decided to rewrite the Open Records Act and abandon it, not abide by it at all, and that's what we have here. Thank you, Your Honor.
With the court's permission, I would like to ask one question of State Counsel. Is there any objection to that? Mr. Hicks, may I ask you one question? in response to Justice Heck, you said that the, I believe you said that the trial judge did not have to accept this settlement.
He was not compelled to.
He's
not compelled to. I don't believe
that
it would have been
because of constitutional grounds, or are you saying in any case where all the parties before the court submit a settlement to the trial judge has an independent authority to accept or reject that?
I'm just not familiar. For instance,
I'm just wondering what the
private
principle
personal
is.
Injury action, perhaps, or something like that.
What's the difference in this case and if I sue you for a tort? I mean, what gives the trial judge the more authority?
I would
here?
Say that the fact that the trial judge is elected by at least some of the people and ultimately accountable to them makes a big difference here. And
why would not that
and
make a big
that it in, was invested with so many questions of public interest. I mean,
you can't point to any authority then on that.
I can't off the top of my head.
How about public utility commission against Coke?
I'll be honest with you, I don't quite understand the question.
Well, does a trial court have the power or the authority to reject any settlement? He does it certainly in plea bargain agreements in criminal cases. He does it certainly in family law matters, where minors are involved. Is this any different?
I would just say it is even more important for the trial judge to be able to evaluate the situation here. This trial judge had heard a week's worth of testimony. And so he didn't come into it cold. It wasn't a one-day wonder. It was the same judge that had heard a week's worth of testimony plus several months of very contentious wrangling back and forth over the issues. And so it's a huge difference between that and a more common kind of situation for the trial judge sign on it. I suppose it's possible for trial judges to reject even these private ones sometimes. But.
Any other questions of anybody? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.